I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 50 of The Infectious Myth. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future guests, you can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us and participate in discussions at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you do send in a comment with your mailing address, letting me know how you're staying in touch with the show, I will send you a small gift. A little while ago, Gary Null and I hosted an AIDS special, and one of the focuses was people who've lived with an HIV-positive diagnosis for a long time without AIDS drugs. On that show, filmmaker Joan Shenton talked about her film Positive Hell, that documents the lives of people in northern Spain who are diagnosed HIV-positive while detoxing from heroin or from alcohol, and who have lived with this diagnosis, the vast majority of the time, without AIDS drugs, mostly in good health. In the case of one man in the film, who had struggled with drug abuse and was also a heavy smoker, he did die after the film was completed, but he had lived almost 30 years with this diagnosis. The average time between HIV and the onset of AIDS is believed to be 10 years, so he'd vastly outlived the estimate of his lifespan. These people are not uncommon. In fact, even the AIDS establishment has a name for them, long-term non-progressors, or LTNPs. These are people who've lived for a long time after a positive HIV test, usually more than 10 years, in good health, without any AIDS-defining diseases, and without ever taking AIDS drugs. Doctors also insist that they must have high CD4 immune cell counts, but we know that CD4 cell counts are unreliable indicators of immune system health, so there are probably a lot of people who are not given this label just for this reason, even though they are also healthy without AIDS drugs. Worse yet, low CD4 counts are taken as a surrogate for ill health. So many healthy HIV positives with low counts are persuaded, even bullied, to take AIDS drugs, following which they start to get health problems blamed on AIDS. In fact, in the United States, since 1993, a low CD4 immune cell count combined with a positive HIV test is considered AIDS. There's apparently no other country in the world that's taken this definition, but this has led to the majority of people being diagnosed with AIDS without actually having any AIDS-defining illnesses at the time of their diagnosis. Many such people experience AIDS-defining illnesses only after they go on the AIDS drugs, which follows the diagnosis of AIDS. More recently, as so-called viral load tests became more popular, a new term was invented: elite controllers. These are the same as LTNPs, except that instead of a high CD4 count — high is supposed to be good for CD4 counts — they have undetectable viral load. Low is supposed to be good for viral load counts. We also know that viral load tests have a lot of problems. They do not detect a virus, despite the suggestive name, and they do not align with other measurements. One study, for example, found that viral load counted 60,000 times more so-called virus than cell culture, which should theoretically be a better method. Another study found very little negative correlation between CD4 counts and viral load. By negative correlation, I mean that if viral load measures the virus and CD4 counts measure the damage done by the virus, viral load counts should go up as CD4 counts go down, and vice versa. But overall, this situation is not found. One paper found only a 5% correlation between CD4 counts and viral load. Another major flaw is that there has never been widespread testing of the HIV antibody negative population to see what the background false positive rate of these tests is. What if the rate was 1%? Well then, in America, a country of over 300 million people, there would be 3 million or more false positive viral load tests, compared to only 1 million people who are believed to be HIV infected. No wonder viral load is not supposed to be used for diagnosis. Another problem is if it was used for diagnosis and then there were the majority of people with positive viral load tests had a negative antibody test, there would be a big political problem for the AIDS establishment, because they'd have to try to explain why this was. So the general rule is that you don't get a viral load test unless you've already tested antibody positive, and that way nobody can find out what the rate of false positives is. In this episode, the first interview that I taped for the Gary Null show that we weren't able to use is with a man I'm calling Peter. He was diagnosed in a major American city in 1986, along with many other hemophiliacs. He was unusual in that his mother refused to give him AZT when first offered in 1987 when the drug was approved. And when he came of age, he continued this refusal. And he's healthy today, but mad as hell because he feels that his life has been taken from him. What if people found out he was HIV positive? Would he be shunned or worse? In this interview, his voice has been disguised. The second interview is with German filmmaker Anne Sono, who documented the lives of six women who were all, at the time of filming, HIV positive and healthy. This didn't last, unfortunately. Tragedy seems to dog HIV positive people. One of them couldn't get treatment for non-AIDS conditions without going on AIDS drugs. One was murdered under mysterious circumstances. One had a healthy child without HIV and then had a child taken from her. One of them was savagely attacked by the judicial system. In many such cases, these deaths are blamed on AIDS. Carrie Stokely, who is in the film, for example, took AIDS drugs for almost a decade and also suffered a botched birth that created lifetime health problems for her. Maria Papagiannadou, who is not in the film, took ARVs for 12 years. And while her health rebounded when she finally went off the drugs, she eventually got severe anemia, which her husband believes was due to the drugs. But AIDS doctors, of course, believed it was due to HIV, even though anemia is not an AIDS-defining condition, but is one of the most common AIDS drug side effects. Let's now go to the interview with Peter. Today, I'm talking with Peter, not his real name, who was diagnosed HIV positive as a hemophiliac many years ago. Despite warnings from doctors, he's never taken AIDS drugs and remains in excellent health today. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Yes, thank you.
So, you were diagnosed at a major American city, along with many other hemophiliacs. About when was this?
This is approximately 1986.
1986?
Yes.
So this was only 2 years after the HIV test.
Yeah, basically, as soon as the test was available, they started pushing it on the entire hemophiliac population.
And so in 1986, that was a year before AZT came available. So what did they say about doing anything about AIDS in when you were first diagnosed?
Well, they called me in with my parents, and they more or less read the Riot Act. I wasn't sick. That was the first thing. And most hemophiliacs were not sick. I want to make that clear at the beginning, that at the time, there was a lot of fear-mongering in the population and the media because of what was happening to gays. They had numerous things like Kaposi sarcoma, PCP, whatnot. But in the hemophilia the population, they were suffering from bleeds and complications from hemophilia therapy, which were very specific to their situation.
Yes.
And it was even age-specific. The older hemophiliacs who had suffered through a product of less quality had suffered more bleeds and had more complications. But they were not, by definition, on their deathbed or very sick people. The lifespan of hemophiliacs had, in fact, by the late 70s, early 80s, had dramatically improved.
Right, as the purity of the factor VIII, the clotting factor, had improved.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it was still a cumbersome thing because there were all kinds of additives and foreign proteins and things they put in it.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, it worked. And the only problem I had was bleeding episodes.
Right.
I was not sick by any definition. I didn't have any illness whatsoever.
Right.
I want to make that clear because the scientific community, they've tried to lie and say two things. That the hemophiliac population was on death's door at the time of testing, and that a mystery virus came out of nowhere and was wreaking havoc. There was no such thing. What happened was that mass testing started immediately.
Yeah, so anyway, I mean, it sounds like there was probably a lot of panic in the hemophiliac community because they all expected that they would be getting sick with things other than bleeding episodes very soon.
Yeah, well, that was what the doctors were telling us. Because the first thing I discussed with my mom was that I was completely healthy, so I had nothing to worry about. And then my understanding was that if you had antibodies, based on what you you know, just general talk of what vaccines or other things were, that was a good thing, that perhaps your immune system was working. And this is what I said to the doctor at the time in my late teens. I said, I'm not sick, there's nothing wrong with me, and all you're telling me is I have antibodies, and I don't know for what, but there's no symptom here of anything. And then he said, no, you're absolutely wrong. This is different. These antibodies it's a whole different thing, and you're at risk for a terrible illness. And that they told you could die, you know. Right. That was a thing. Even many years later, I was told I could be dead in 2 years. And all this time, every checkup, you're talking now almost 30 years of medical, all types of medical appointments and checkups, everything. There's not one illness, nothing, except for the common cold and hemophilia, nothing.
Right.
And at that time, because these hemophiliacs were given full dosage AZT, most died within the first 2 years of that treatment. And then they started lowering the doses. And then they lived longer, but the majority of the ones from my time died within 10 years. I would say, you know, probably 90%. And then you'd have a few small percentage that maybe they survived a little better on the drugs, but eventually they would die later.
Right, so to recap, 1987 is when AZT came out, so I presume that at that point you got a pretty hard sell on this drug's necessary for your
health. Oh, absolutely. I mean, they, because I was still in my teens, they tried to work on my mom, and they said that it's preventative, you know, that you should. This is in the best interest of your child. He could get sick if you don't treat him, you know, immediately, you know, and give him these doses and whatnot. And the thing about it is, independently, I was having discussions with my mom because the hemophiliacs we observed were very, very sick, and we noticed them getting progressively worse.
These are hemophiliacs who had gone on AZT.
Yes. They had weight loss, hair loss, skin problems. They looked anemic. We heard things like they were throwing up at night on the medications. And I think my mom told me a conversation she had with the nurse saying that, if he gets sick, then we can discuss medications, but he's healthy, and it doesn't sound good. I mean, that the more they keep dosing them with these meds, they get sicker and sicker. So, we made this decision right off the bat. We were noticing it, the high mortality rate, and so we just said, absolutely not, you know, and this has been for me, 30 years, almost 30 years, of trying to fight this thing, because I think it's clear that they were misdiagnosed. I think it's proven with the now going back. The problem is that they've killed so many of them, it would be harder now in court to have them available in court to testify. But I'd be glad to take the place of them and an anomaly. I just happened to be one in a lottery that didn't succumb to these drugs when I was completely healthy.
Right. There's a paper by Darby, I can't remember, it's in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, that shows in England the death rate amongst hemophiliacs rose only in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
That they've been diagnosing hemophiliacs HIV positive between 1984 and 1987, but it was only when AZT came out.
Absolutely. I mean, the irony of the whole thing is that at that time, pre the AZT and other drugs, if a hemophiliac was walking down the street and he didn't have a physical bleed, internal bleed, you could not differentiate a hemophiliac from a person on the street. Basically they were just normal, except that if they had a hemorrhage, they would treat it.
Well, it's a little bit like somebody who uses insulin for diabetes, if they keep
their
diabetes...
Yeah, very much so. Although I'd qualify that, I would say that the hemophiliacs of the previous generation who didn't get as good clotting factors had more bleeds. So they might have had injuries or that they might slightly incapacitated. But of the later generation, I would say by the 80s, if they were under 20 or thereabouts, they were okay as far as bleeding was concerned. I mean, they might have to bleed. They might have to treat more than once for a bleed, but they were not dying by any sort. You know, you could expect a relatively normal lifespan.
Right. And in the early days, how many years did the doctors tell you that you had if you didn't take drugs?
Well, actually, one nurse told me up front that you could be dead in 2 years. So the idea was that if you didn't take the drugs, you were crazy. And that you were not doing your due diligence, and that you were careless, you were reckless. Any question you had, even if you said, look, you're healthy, and they said you should start the drugs immediately, they didn't do an analysis or look at the patients and say, wait a minute, these are healthy people, and they have no symptoms. Aside from hemophilia and bleeding episodes, they just started pumping them with these toxic drugs, high doses of AZT.
Even when the medical staff started to see their hemophiliacs dying from things that they hadn't been dying with before, that didn't change their...
No, it actually got worse, because as they actually went in, at first there was the AZT, and they had a lot of the weight loss and the anemia and things, and then later in the 90s, some of the protease drugs came on the market, and the overwhelming symptoms were the liver failure. And I met some of these hemophiliacs. They were on the drugs. And for the most part, they had no liver left. The drugs had completely destroyed that and their kidneys. You started to see, when they moved into different kinds of drugs, that the side effects became extreme, depending on what they were giving them. And, you know, there was nothing I could do about it. I mean, I suspected the doctors kind of knew. They had some inclination of what was going on, but it was just protocol. They just kept dying, and the hemophilia organizations supported it, because they kind of were aligned with the pharmaceutical companies, and it was promoted. The drugs were promoted,
right.
And then later the government came out with compensation plans. So it was kind of everything was testing drugs, and then we'll take care of you. Either you die or you're on some monetary plan, but basically you had no life. You were totally controlled by these people.
And how did being HIV positive affect your life as you grew up?
Sorry?
How did being HIV positive affect your life socially?
Well, in every way. I mean, all the relationships I wanted to continue with, I had to discontinue because of fear of incarceration or the criminal... the type of laws that still exist today, but that came down on anyone who's so-called HIV positive. They're restricted from just about every aspect of as I said, relationships, marriage. It affects their jobs, friendships, their whole life, and they're stigmatized too. I mean, and the campaign that... You know, that was another thing in which I don't want to go into, but the whole idea that you have an infectious disease based upon a non-specific antibody test.
Right.
And you have no symptoms whatsoever. That made absolutely no sense. And, you know, from the very beginning, you know, I think this is a criminal act. And that the fraud can be proven now. And I would like my day in court. I would like to show what happened, and for the other victims to have a voice in this. Because it's time that we are heard. It's time, you know. Everything that has been reported in the media has been a complete, absolute lie. And I would like my day... Well, completely, they're supportive of the pharmaceutical agenda. They have not investigated what these tests are, which they're junk science. I'll say that now. They've not investigated the people responsible who have made billions or even trillions off of this. They've not investigated the AZT holocaust, I would say it is, because it's clear that these patients, whether they were gay, hemophiliacs, people in Africa, wherever, or innocent people, just regular people anywhere, were given AZT. Most died within 2 years. And they had horrific symptoms. I think that can be proven. And, you know, it goes on and on. Every step of the way, they've covered it up.
Yes, well, I agree with you that the medical establishment is obviously largely responsible, but journalists in the mainstream media that have refused to cover this mm-hmm. are also responsible. I think if a journalist, if a doctor came to a journalist and said, oh, I have this amazing patient, I think he has a special gene, mm-hmm. and he's unaffected by HIV, I think the mainstream media would be all over it. But if an individual like yourself goes to the media and says, I've been living for years with HIV without drugs, mm-hmm. they won't talk to you.
Yeah, you know, the way they look at it is that the science has been established, and if you happen to be healthy, you're one in a million, or you're just a special anomaly. And that's what the scientific community has told them. And unfortunately, a lot of people, well, media or otherwise, they've been told the story over and over again, and the survivors are hidden. So they don't get a chance to see that the official story is fake. So that's the problem. And when you have the majority of people told by doctors and or nurses, and generally the medical professionals that they trust, that the tests are accurate and the drugs will help you and all of this, they don't have a counterpoint, or they don't have anyone to turn to. So most people, a lot of people who have survived may have found out things later or have been sort of handcuffed because they don't have a platform to challenge these people. They haven't had their day in court.
Right.
Or the system is set up, as you said, the media, to protect the establishment.
Right.
The majority of people don't hear anything.
Well, thank you very much for coming out of hiding today and sharing your story on this.
I appreciate that very much, and
special.
I hope the truth will get out, that eventually that the people responsible for this will be held accountable at some point, soon, you know, and I can have my life back. 30 years of as you said, hiding in the shadows is much too long, and I'm innocent and healthy, and I'd be willing to tell my story at any point in a real court of law where these people can be forced to testify under oath.
Yes.
Which is what should have happened from day one. You know, to me, it's not a scientific debate. It's a medical fraud and a criminal murder, mass murder, that has been covered up.
Right.
And I think, to just to add in the finality to it, is that the test should be banned. And with that, the toxic drug therapies, everything with this needs a correction, correction. And you know, I don't know. Hopefully we can get back to sanity. You know?
I would hope so, too.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you to Peter for that interview. A little bit of information about hemophiliacs. Around the time of AIDS, started around 1981, there was a transition occurring in the clotting factor that was given to hemophiliacs. It went from what they called intermediate purity factor to high purity factor that was created by genetic engineering. The intermediate factor was about 90% impurities, maybe more than 90% impurities. So there was a lot of exposure to the blood of other people, to foreign blood. And that is, of course, immunosuppressive. So here's some of the science, what was being printed around that time. Here's a paper from 1984. 65% of clotting factor recipients had an abnormal T helper to T suppressor cell ratio. Those are CD4 counts. 40% had a depressed absolute T helper cell level. And 29% had an elevated absolute T suppressor cell count. We found no correlation between paired husband and wife values for T cell ratio or any other immune parameter studied. We conclude that there's no evidence to date for heterosexual household contact transmission of T cell subset abnormalities from hemophiliacs to their spouses in our study populations. So if HIV was being transmitted, that should have meant that the wife, who was not hemophiliac, because hemophilia is generally a male condition, that the wife should have been infected with HIV, and therefore her CD4 cell counts should have dropped, and some kinds of immune abnormalities should have been found, but none were found. Here's a second paper from 1985. In 1984, HIV antibodies developed in 16 patients with hemophilia A. All but one had received a common batch of clotting factor 8. A further 18 patients received the implicated batch A, but have stayed negative for HIV antibodies. The 15 patients who seroconverted became HIV positive used significantly more vials of batch A and also had a higher annual factor 8 consumption than the 18 patients who did not seroconvert. So what this study is showing, it's showing a little bit about the mindset of scientists, because they were looking for contaminated batches rather than looking at the total consumption of clotting factor that was given to hemophiliacs. There are different severities of hemophilia, and those with the more severe hemophilia have to be injected with more factor 8 to maintain their ability for their blood to clot. And what was being found by a few people was it was the total lifetime quantity of factor 8 that was the best predictor for immune suppression, not which batch of factor 8 that you received. Here's another paper from 1986. HIV-positive hemophiliac subjects on average had been exposed to twice as much concentrate, that's clotting factor, during the previous years as seronegative hemophiliac subjects. The seropositive group had a significantly lower mean helper suppressor T-cell ratio, that's a ratio of two different kinds of CD cells, and absolute helper T-cell level that the seronegative group. It is concluded that HIV antibodies occurred with high frequency in hemophiliac subjects and is related to the amount of clotting factor infused. I'm slightly paraphrasing. So what these people found very clearly was it was the amount of clotting factor that was the factor that all, that produced people to be HIV positive and also to reduce their CD4 cell counts, although they were called helper T cells in those days. And this also shows you that there's a correlation between HIV antibodies and the CD4 cell counts. So when you become HIV positive and your CD4 cell count drops, it's assumed that it's the HIV that's causing it. But if the HIV antibodies don't actually indicate that you're infected with HIV, and that all both tests are doing is showing that you're a bit immune suppressed or a lot immune suppressed, then they may not indicate that you're infected with a particular virus. Here's another paper from 1991. Early in 1988, 13 patients were elected to receive monoclonal antibody purified factor 7. This is high purity blood clotting concentrate. The CD4 value for 12 patients in the high purity group is 308 plus or minus 158, not significantly different from the baseline value. In other words, their CD4 cell counts did not drop. On the other hand, the CD4 value for the subjects treated with intermediate purity concentrate fell significantly to about half that. While five subjects in the high purity group had an increase in CD4 counts, all patients receiving intermediate purity concentrate had a decrease. So this is again saying that when hemophiliacs were being injected with what's misleadingly called intermediate purity clotting factor, which is the vast majority of which is actually not clotting factor, their CD4 cell counts dropped. But when they used the new high purity clotting factor, CD4 counts stayed stable or even increased. Here's another paper from 1995. In a study of British hemophiliacs with a median seroconversion date of late 1982, so this is very early in the so-called AIDS epidemic, the annual death rate in patients with severe hemophilia remained steady at 8 per 1,000 during 1977 to 84, but then rose progressively to 38 in 91 to 92. The increase was confined to patients who tested seropositive for HIV, and among whom the death rates increased steeply from 1985, reaching 81 per 1,000 in 1991 to 92. Among moderate to mild hemophilia patients who were HIV positive, the death rate again rose steeply during 1985 to 92. Treatment against PCP pneumonia or with AZT, which was the first AIDS drugs approved, has been widespread for HIV-infected hemophiliacs since about 1989, actually probably a bit earlier since AZT was first approved in 1987. However, the steady increase in the excess death rate from 1985 to 1992 suggests that in this population, the increasing impact of HIV-associated mortality has not been halted by these treatments. So again, we're seeing the mentality of the doctors and researchers. They could not see that it was the fact that HIV-positive hemophiliacs were the only ones being prescribed AZT and also being aggressively treated for PCP pneumonia, often without actual proof that they had it. They could not see that it was their drugs that were killing the HIV-positive hemophiliacs. So the HIV-positive hemophiliacs were more likely to be taking intermediate purity factor, more likely to have severe hemophilia, more likely to be taking PCP prophylaxis, more likely to be taking AZT. So they had this huge burden going against them. So it's not really surprising that they had this huge death rate. But nobody was really interested in finding out that the death rate was actually caused by the treatment. And if all hemophiliacs had been moved to high purity factor, they might have found that the death rate in hemophiliacs dropped considerably in all groups, HIV positive or negative. And here's the last word from Dr. Peter Duisberg, who wrote this in 2003. He says, in 1989, we presented a report of the immunosuppressive effect of commercially available non-heat-treated factor VIII concentrates, which were grossly contaminated with other blood products in the purification procedure at the time. Factor 13, one of the impurities, the lesser-known culprit than the more widely acknowledged HIV, is a contributing factor to immunosuppression in AIDS-associated hemophilia, and even today has remained consistently ignored in discussions of the impropriety of the use of factor VIII concentrates, the lower purity factors. So it might not have been the contaminated blood supply in the 1980s that was the problem. It was the fact that the factor VIII was not very pure. And if the concentration had been moving everybody to the high purity factor VIII and ramping up production of high purity factor VIII, which would have been expensive, but we are talking about people's lives, then maybe this whole massive genocide almost in hemophiliacs would have been avoided. And now let's move on to the discussion with Ann Sono, a filmmaker and producer of the film I Won't Go Quietly. Ann Sono is a German filmmaker. Her recent film, I Won't Go Quietly, documents the struggles of six HIV-positive women to reject their diagnosis and the consequent death wish of society. She's also working on a new film on cancer and a book on HIV, which will include more stories and the reasons she got involved in the issue in the first place. Welcome, Anne.
Hi, David.
It's good to talk to you again. The six stories in your film are really quite amazing, and I don't know which ones to briefly discuss in the short time that we have. I found it interesting. Two of the women, Tamara and Titania, had children. Tamara had a child with no drugs at all, and Titania only discovered that AZT was a toxic poison during her pregnancy. Do you want to talk a little bit about those two women?
Yes, the two women are from Russia. And what was very interesting for me to discover is that the freedom of speech seemed to be more open in Russia than in our Western countries. So Tamara discovered that there is something wrong about the official theory about HIV and AIDS in a newspaper. And this was Tatiana.
Oh,
and Tamara was given a book in a consultant, AIDS consultant, from an AIDS consultant at the church, mm-hmm. Catholic Orthodox Church, who gave her a critical book about AIDS. And so that was during pregnancy, shortly after she was diagnosed. And so she read this book immediately, and it was immediately clear to her not to take the drugs, not to believe what the doctors are telling her, that she is deadly ill and right. she should prevent her child getting infected. So she refused everything. And she was very successful with this. So she even decided together with her husband to have another child shortly afterwards, all perfectly healthy. But yes, what happened to Tamara was really, really crucial, because she was murdered the same night when we had the premiere of the film in Berlin.
Really? And do you think there was a connection between her murder and her the film, or her status, or like?
Well, I have no proof for this. But it's kind of, it's really a coincidence that it was the same night. And so for me, it's quite clear that there is a connection. But the official criminal, I mean, there was one man who said, I did this, and he was sent to prison for 7 years. Which is a very low sentence.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not very many years.
So people said, who had been there for the trial, they said, it is clear that he was not the only one.
Oh.
But there is no, because now the husband and also the mother of Tamara agreed to this sentence. So now the files are closed and there's no further
investigation.
It's now, yeah.
Yeah. So, but the children in the case of Tamara and Titania, the children were born healthy and have stayed healthy?
Well, the children of Tamara are really in a very good health, and the child of Tatiana went ill after she was taking a swim in a lake, local lake, and she got really ill. Samara suspects it's because of the pollution of this lake.
Mm-hmm.
But then immediately the doctor said, now it is AIDS.
Oh, of course.
And yes, because the child had also got this diagnostic, right. HIV positive, and so now the child of Tatiana is unfortunately also on forced treatment. She's now 11 years old, 10 or 11 years old, and yeah, this is her
situation now. How old was she when she got sick?
This was 2 years ago.
So she was 9. So she had 9 years of health. And they still wanted to force her onto the drugs.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, the problem, the big problem is for people who stand up and who dare to speak out, we have this label, we have this diagnostic.
Right.
But we don't want to take the drugs. As soon as they get a health problem, it's immediately AIDS. And so they are not allowed to get sick. And once they get sick, everybody thinks it's AIDS. You know,
no matter what it is, yes.
Yes, yes.
Another interesting story is the story of Lene Halstad. And hers is quite different because she ended up going to jail for 2 years, which I believe was because society thought that she had endangered one of her former lovers. Can you describe a little bit more about that situation?
Yes, so Lena was in a relationship. She revealed her status, her HIV right. positive status. And but this relationship was very violent, so finally Lene broke up with him, And after that, the ex-partner brought her to jail, brought her to court, saying she had infected him without saying anything with HIV.
Right, because how would she prove that she'd said it unless it was written on paper?
Yes, there is no proof. I mean, this is an intimated situation. You don't have a normally, you don't have a witness. And it was the judges, it was not how could they prove, how could they know that it was Lina who infected him? I mean,
right.
This is, and so they said because Lina had this so-called HIV-2 and he had also this HIV-2, it must have been Lina who gave it to him.
Right. And so just a jealous ex-boyfriend. I mean, people who are HIV positive are very vulnerable to that kind of thing, because even if they tell their partner, use a condom, get their consent, it's all verbal. And so if the partner turns around, if they break up and the partner turns around and decides to hate them, whether it's a man or a woman, they can accuse them of never informing of anything, never using a condom, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. I mean, it could be said it's kind of castration, because I know some people also, Tatiana said this to us, she's avoiding any relationship because of this.
Right, so, because if she has another child, she could end up with her child on drugs. And if she has a sexual relationship, she could end up in jail.
Yes.
That's really sad. One of the other tragic stories, I mean, these stories all have their up and downs, was Carrie Stokely, who I believe was on the drugs for about 10 years, and before her husband, I think, discovered alternative information. And in the end, she died, which some people have said she died of AIDS. But, you know, what's your take on that story?
Well, I mean, being on this highly toxic drug is very dangerous for your body. And she was on the drugs 11 years before she quit. It was 2007 when she quit, when she found out this information and quit cold turkey. But her body had been very damaged already by these drugs. So this is one part of the story, and the other part is that she already had a very weak area because of a cesarean section, which did not went well.
Yeah.
So, and this was the two reasons. And the third one is the husband sent me the blood results. She got tested, her blood got tested 1 year before she died, and she had a very high heavy metal. And this figures itself could be deadly. So
but why,
I mean,
why would she have heavy metals in her body?
We don't know. We don't know.
Yes. I mean, it could be environmental pollution, but that would probably mean that her husband also was at risk.
Yes, it could be. We don't know. Yeah. So I think it's multi
factorial.
Yeah. Yes. And so in the end, it was like she had a hole in her colon and she needed surgery. And the doctors did not want to operate her except she would go on highly toxic drugs.
Right.
And so she had to. There was no other choice. And she agreed. And it was ganciclovir, which is also a very toxic drug. And then after that, she never regained health.
Yes, yes. I knew Carrie a little bit because I saw her at the RA 2009 conference. And then I visited her and her husband in Florida one time. And she was already quite ill and in extreme pain at that time.
Okay.
It was really tragic.
Okay.
The fact that she couldn't get good, you know, she couldn't really get treated for what was wrong with her. They desperately wanted to treat her for AIDS. And ganciclovir is a nucleoside analog, just like AZT. So it's not technically an AIDS drug, but it's got the similar toxicity profile.
Yes.
Which is horrible. Mm. I mean, there seems to be tragedy in all of these stories. I mean, where do you get hope from after you tell these stories? I mean, they all have really horrible things that have happened, related in some cases to the social stigma of AIDS and HIV.
Yes.
So, where do you get hope from?
Well, it's my experience with the film. So it's out now, the film, since 3 years, and my experience is that more and more people get aware of this. So really, this is what I call the consciousness is really rising, and people are questioning things which they never questioned before. And also doctors are more and more saying to me, yes, you are right, we know it is like that, we know it's all a lie, we can't speak publicly about that, this is not possible, because then we will lose our permission to practice and things like that. But more and more people, they get aware. And in my opinion, we are shortly before that all these lies. I mean, HIV is just one example for a lot of lies, especially in the medical field, but not exclusively. And so we are now in the area where we are fighting very much. But for me, it's a good signal, because there is this quote from, I don't know if you know that quote from Mahatma Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you will win. So we are now in the state of that they fight against us.
Yes, and I think other stories on this show today are going to show similar things.
Yes.
I would just like to thank you for sharing some information about your film. And if people would like to see your film, how can they go about doing that?
Well, it's available on DVD in altogether 9 languages now. It could be ordered at www.bluebell.de. Or it's also for free in a lower quality on YouTube.
Okay.
And I'm sure you will put the link.
Yes, we will
to
put
both.
The link.
Yes,
to,
yes.
I won't go quietly. Both YouTube and mm-hmm. your site where people can purchase the DVD. Thank you very much, Anne. Thanks for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Thank you for your work.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, David.
Many thanks to Anne Sono for that interview. One of the things that happened to several of the women in the film, certainly not all of them, was that there was pressure for them to take AZT, this drug that was approved in 1987, and for their children to take AZT. AZT is also known as retrovir and zidovudine. Here's a little bit of scientific information about the use of AZT in mothers and children. Children treated with AZT continue to have bacterial and opportunistic infections. One or more episodes of blood toxicity, that's anemia, occurred in 61%. That's a paper from 1991. Paper from 1994. We noted 10% birth defects out of 8 out of 80, and 8 spontaneous fetal losses for a total of 17% abnormal pregnancies. Another paper from 1997. 2 cases of severe pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, which is an AIDS-defining pneumonia, in infants who were perinatally exposed to HIV and AZT, but who were uninfected with HIV. So these are children who did not have HIV, according to the doctors, but were exposed to AZT, presumably because their mothers were HIV positive. And they came down with a severe pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. 1998 paper. In HIV-infected pregnant women treated with 2 drugs in the class of AZT, one or more adverse events occurred in 29 out of 37 women and in 14 out of 30 babies. Incorporation of AZT, this is a paper from 1999, incorporation of AZT into DNA was detected in most of the samples from AZT-exposed adults and infants. What does this mean? Well, if AZT is getting into your DNA, it's going to disrupt the behavior of any cell that's affected in this way. So that's potentially extremely serious. 1999, comparison of HIV-infected children whose mothers were treated with AZT with children whose mothers were not treated showed that the former group had a 1.8 times higher probability of developing severe disease or severe immune suppression and had a lower survival. More of them died. Another paper from 1999. The data shows that AZT crosses the human placenta and becomes rapidly incorporated into the DNA of placental tissues. The long-term consequences of transplacental AZT exposure remain unknown. In mice, AZT is a moderate to strong transplacental carcinogen that's cancer-causing when administered during the last third of gestation. 1999, the UK's Committee on Safety of Medicines has issued a warning to doctors about the risk of mitochondrial dysfunction in infants born to HIV-infected mothers treated with AZT. The mitochondria are the organelles in every living cell in your body that process energy. Without mitochondria, we cannot live. Regarding mitochondrial dysfunction, here's another paper from 1999. 8 children with mitochondrial dysfunction were found. The first had visual impairment and died aged 13 months because of respiratory and cardiac disorders. The second, from age 4 months until death at 11, had epilepsy and deterioration of cognitive and psychomotor abilities. At age 8 months, patient 3 had a seizure. At age 4 years, the child's cardiac function was normal, but moderate muscular deficit persisted. In the fourth patient, between ages 14 and 27 months, the child had 4 episodes of febrile seizures. Going on, patient 6 was symptom-free until 14 months, but persistent biochemical abnormalities were seen on follow-up. Patient 7 was symptom-free until age 4 months, at which time he had low muscle tone and stopped breathing. The 8th child was symptom-free. Persistent hepatic and liver and pancreas abnormalities were seen from birth. At age 20 months, biological abnormalities persisted, and there were abnormalities in the brain. No child was infected with HIV, which means that HIV cannot be blamed for the health problems that they had. It must be due to the exposure of drugs when their mothers were pregnant. Here's another paper from the year 2000. After adjusting for prematurity and maternal clinical characteristics, rapid disease progression was 3 times more likely to occur in infants born to mothers treated with AZT compared with findings in untreated mothers. Paper from the same year, 2000. Children of study women who were prescribed AZT had increased odds of any anomaly more than 50% higher than people not taking the drugs. Also the year 2000, in a study of 325 HIV-infected children born during 1986 to 1997, clinical progression was compared among infected children exposed or unexposed to AZT during prenatal and perinatal periods. That's while as a fetus, prenatal, and shortly after birth, perinatal. AZT exposure was associated with 1.8-fold increased risk of progressing to AIDS or death. Another paper from the year 2000. They list factors associated with lower cumulative survival, and those included the drug AZT. There was a big debate around that time on the issue of whether there should be mandatory testing for HIV in pregnant women, even though pregnancy is known to be a risk factor for a false positive test. One potential drawback to voluntary testing is the unknown toxicity of AZT. It says, Convincing pregnant women, especially African Americans, to use AZT or other antiviral drugs may be difficult. One study showed that African American women hold disturbing views towards AZT use. For instance, some respondents said that AZT could harm them. Others said the drug was indiscriminately prescribed, while others were unwilling to use it because AZT had not been tested on women of color. A number of respondents indicated that AZT use was a way for pharmaceutical companies to make money. I must say I have a lot of respect for these women. I think they know, they knew back then what was going on. What's really scary about this is that, as documented in this film in some cases and in many other cases that I'm familiar with, women are threatened with the loss of their children unless they accept AZT for their children, and they're coerced into taking it themselves, because if they don't take it, they will be seen as non-compliant and their children may be taken from them because of the fear that they won't give AZT to their children. It's probably a realistic fear. I hope that all this information has helped you think a little bit about HIV and whether people who are HIV positive really need to take drugs or not. There's a tremendous amount of fear about this issue, and I think listening to real people's stories helps give more perspective. Scientific information is one thing that's important, but also the stories of individuals are very important. Thank you for listening to yet another episode of The Infectious Myth. I'll be back soon. Goodbye.